This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This is National Child Abuse Prevention Month, and as we draw to the near end of April for this month, we're going to find out about another annual event which has come up, the 29th Annual Forum on Child Abuse and Neglect. It's coming up this coming Friday on the Indiana University Northwest campus, where the IU Northwest School of Public and Environmental Affairs, or SPIA as it's often known as, along with a lot of community partners, are going to get together and put on this annual forum. It'll be held at the Bruce Berglund Auditorium in the Savannah Center on the Gary campus, and we have with us the creator of the center some 29, I guess now, years ago. We have Dr. Rick Hug with us. Dr. Hug, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you.
Well, for folks that are not necessarily familiar with the forum itself, how did you and your colleagues at IU Northwest get it started?
Well, I think back in the 90s, it was clearly an important problem. And one of the things that I was influenced by an academic article and by a former chancellor at Indiana University Northwest. And she argued that one of the things that universities could do, universities can sometimes get involved in controversial things, but one thing they ought to be able to do is do things that are right for kids. And I think that was one of the things. And I've been a foster parent, and so I knew it was important to work on having kids' lives be better over the years. So that was sort of the genesis of it. And the community partners came aboard early and have stayed all the time through. It's been a good partnership of the university with a variety of community organizations over the years.
Now, they do range from not only local, but I guess regional as well, too, don't they?
We try to reach out to Lake Porter and LaPorte counties, but we occasionally have folks from the southern counties down in the region, too. And yes, we're over the years, we've grown quite a bit, and we have people coming from greater distances to see us.
Now, with the event getting underway on Friday, it starts out with the usual get-together and talk about issues and the like, and then goes into the keynote address. Tell us a little bit about the keynote speaker this year, Lori Poland. And she has a very interesting background and how she's gotten herself established in dealing with the problems of child abuse and neglect.
Yes, Lori Poland is our speaker. She's from the Denver area, and she experienced what probably, when you think of the worst thing that can happen to a child, that's probably what happened to Lori Poland. When she was 3 years old, she was abducted from her front yard by a stranger, and this is it's the exception, I think, but this really was, hey, little girl, would you like some candy sort of situation. But anyway, she was abducted and taken to a remote area in near Denver and left in an outdoor toilet, in the pit of an outdoor toilet. She was there for, I believe, about 2 days before she was found by some hikers in the area. So that experience, and also, unfortunately, some other abuse and neglect in her life, shaped her. She grew up to become a therapist, and very recently, she teamed up with her therapist in the very early days after her abduction, a doctor from the Denver area, and they just recently teamed up to form a foundation to end child abuse and neglect. So she will be there to talk about her experience and her way back from this horrific experience to show that even after terrible abuse and neglect, that the human spirit is resilient and it is possible to come back to have love instead of hatred, to flourish instead of being crushed by something like this. So she will be back to tell us about her journey and also to talk about how she has established this foundation with her therapist.
Since there are going to be a number of workshops and the like that are going to happen during the day on Friday, I know some of it is the breakout after the hearing what Lori Poland has to say and her experiences and how she's grown from all of the very traumatic issues that, she's had to deal with, into dealing with issues on a local basis here. I guess the first of the workshops is going to involve some representatives from Lake County as well as from the State Department of Child Services. Tell us how all of these very specialized workshops seem to fit in together with the overall theme for the work for the event itself all day long.
Okay, well, we do have representatives from the Department of Child Services and the local juvenile judge, and most years we have them each do a panel so that people in the community can hear about what's happening with child welfare issues in the area. This year we also have someone from Indianapolis, from the Department of Child Services, the deputy director, who will be there to talk about the recent changes in DCS policy over the last year. There are lots of things happening that are different in DCS, and he will be there to talk about that. We'll also have from Indianapolis Sharon Pierce, who's the director of Prevent Child Abuse Indiana. We try to join forces with people all over the state to celebrate Child Abuse and Neglect Prevention Month. And those two folks will be coming from Indianapolis to help close out the session. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the theme is always ending child abuse and neglect, figuring out how we're going to try to go about doing that.
I always note that you like to bring in Northwest Indiana people as much as you can. Of course, it is a Northwest-centric event that happens at IU Northwest. But in this case, I know one of the workshops is going to include North Township Trustee Frank Mervan. And he and his team members are working very hard. And in fact, Trustee Mervan himself working on a very important project, which is entitled No More Secrets. He's had a number of opportunities to make presentations all across the region to talk with students and grown-ups alike about the issues dealing with child sexual abuse here. Tell us more about what Frank Mervan and his colleagues are going to be talking about in their session.
Yes, I think they will be talking about their project, how it started, and they were at the forum a couple of years ago, and their project has grown. They are not only working in the area. I noticed recently that they've been down to the Indianapolis area also. But their project is No More Secrets, and the idea is to identify, to get folks, children who've been sexually abused, to get them to talk about them, to come out of the shadows, and to begin dealing with the trauma they've experienced. Their project has been successful in passing legislation. Their school systems are looking at ways to get at child sexual abuse, identify, and move into treatment. And the Trustee Mervan and his team have been very useful, very helpful in getting that legislation process moving forward. Several school districts have initiated very special child sexual abuse training called Stewards of Children, and the Northwest area is a leader in the state in this particular regard. We have we're moving forward with more school districts than other places in the state, and it's something that I think will happen more and more throughout the state in the coming years.
We're talking with Dr. Rick Hugg, who is at Indiana University Northwest, about the 29th Annual Forum on Child Abuse and Neglect that's going to happen on the Gary campus. It'll be at the Berglund Auditorium in the Savannah Center on Friday. And there are a number, I understand, of some new workshops that are planned for this year's forum, dealing with some of the most contemporary issues and problems that do have a bearing on child abuse and neglect. And one of them, unfortunately, is the opioid epidemic. Tell us what's going to come about in that part of the workshop on Friday.
Yes, that is a very special workshop. The opioid epidemic, I think, is obviously quite well known, but what is not as often shared is the minority perspective on this particular issue. And what we have is a video that appeared in the public TV in the Indianapolis area, produced it in conjunction with the Indiana Minority Health Coalition and others. And it's a discussion of leaders, including a Harvard law professor, about the experience that minorities have had with the opioid epidemic. And following the video, there will be a discussion And we expect that will be a very well-attended and very important session to get a different perspective on the epidemic.
I understand that the issue of school dropouts seems to come up here, because I know a lot has been proven that young people who have been abused as children have problems in school, oftentimes all through their education, and sometimes that leads to dropouts and all. But sometimes violence gets in the way too. If you will, tell us a little bit about what Laura Smith Wynn and some of her colleagues from the Indiana Parenting Institute are going to talk about.
Yes, they will be talking about, you're exactly right, the issue of I think the point of that is that there are particular times that are absolutely critical in dropouts, that catching kids at just the right time to prevent that. And they have been working in the area on this, and they will be giving the strategies that they would have for parents and school people to keep kids in school at those critical times and hopefully present some of the more dreadful outcomes that are possible when kids get away from school.
One of the other issues that come up, I guess, also in relationship to the entire issue of child abuse and neglect, maybe the gender or the gender identification of a young person and family members that are involved in this, too. Tell us what Natalie Lukic is going to talk about. She's going to bring up how the subject of LGBTQAI+ is fitting into all of this. Is this one of the new workshops, or is this a continuation of something that's maybe started recently?
This is a workshop actually that we've had for 4 or 5 years, and it is we think one of our very, very important workshops. The obviously gender identity is a critical issue, and it's getting more and more attention. And in terms of difficulties that families have, issues around lesbian, gay, transsexual, bisexual, questioning, those issues are issues that can potentially cause serious trouble with both the individuals involved and also the relationships and families. And we've felt for some time that it was important that we address that, because preventing child abuse and neglect is all about helping children and families deal with life. And we think that Natalie Lukic has done a great job in raising these issues. Every year we have a very relatively small group, but we think a very important discussion with Natalie Lukic, and it's an opportunity to get connected to others that are dealing with the issues that with LGBTQAI issues, as the latest acronym is.
Dr. Hugg, since you've had the opportunity to be fortunate to be able to help bring this forum along all these years to cover all the topics that involve child abuse and neglect, what have you seen in the years since it began that folks who are involved on this issue every single day, the folks that are counselors that are working with the DCS and with the local agencies as well, what do you see that they seem to be able to take away from attending the conference every year?
I think one of the things is that they are not they're not fighting this alone, that there are others who are involved in it, that it is not unusual for this type of work to take a toll. And we try every year to have something that will help help our workers do self-care. It is very difficult work. It is, we talk about trauma. There's trauma that comes with dealing with trauma. And we're very much aware of that. And one of the things is, besides some self-help sorts of workshops from time to time, it's just being together. I remember something that one of the recent directors said. And what she said was, she was the director of DCS. She said that she doesn't know that she could do what some of her workers do, investigating deaths of children, making decisions on whether to remove children from their home. That was interesting to me, because she had what I thought was one of the most difficult jobs, managing the organization that did all of that. But her message was, and I think it's a message for all of us, We have to do our parts, whatever that might be, to help children and families. For some, it will be more engagement. For others, it may be serving as a mentor, serving as a CASA volunteer, making donations to organizations that help, volunteering that help, or something as simple as helping a family on the block with a problem that they may have. We all have to do our small parts or big parts in helping children and families deal with this issue. And I think that's probably one of the biggest takeaways and one of the things that we tell each other each year at this thing. We have to do our parts, like the sports analyses, do your job, do your part, and together we can end child abuse and neglect.
Well, Dr. Huck, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about what's going to be talked about in more detail at the 29th Annual Forum for Child Abuse and Neglect on Friday at the IU Northwest campus. And thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks much, Chris.
Dr. Rick Hugg is one of the, in fact, he's the creator of the annual forum on child abuse and neglect that's been held for now, would be the 29th year at the IU Northwest campus. It'll be held on Friday beginning at 9 a.m. in the Bruce Berglund Auditorium, which is located in the Savannah Center. Throughout the year, SideFX Public Media is reporting on the many healthcare challenges that refugees and other immigrants face. The first story in the series focuses on a man who fled Luanda in the mid-1990s ethnic genocide. He was troubled by many mental health problems, but he's founded a nonprofit to help others like him. Here's Lauren Bavis.
Kizito Kalima was 14 years old at the start of the Rwandan genocide. Over just a few months in 1994, hundreds of thousands of Tutsi people were killed, including most of his family.
It's hard to understand. It's hard to understand if you never lived through it.
Kalima was bashed over the head with a machete, beaten up, and left in a ditch filled with dead bodies. He escaped into the jungle, where he lived for 3 months, eating grass and drinking swamp water.
It was just very shocking, and it took me a while to figure out what was going on.
I'm sitting with Kalima in his office at the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation in Indianapolis. He came to the U.S. on a basketball scholarship after living as a refugee in East Africa. Now, the nonprofit he founded raises awareness of genocide and other human rights atrocities. It also connects immigrants and refugees to mental health resources.
Everybody who has been through any kind of civil war, any conflict, somehow, some way you have some sort of mental health issues.
Research shows the trauma many refugees suffer before coming to the U.S. and the difficulties they face starting over in a new country can cause anxiety, depression, and other mental health problems. Diane Mitschke of the University of Texas at Arlington says rates of post-traumatic stress disorder in refugees are especially high.
Sometimes as much as 10 times the rates that we see in a typical American population.
It's especially a problem for people who fled war-torn countries like Iraq, Syria, and Burma.
Previously, there were a lot of issues with the military in Burma targeting and harming the people.
That's Chelsea Davey of Exodus Refugee Immigration. The Indianapolis-based organization settled more than 1,600 refugees in the city in the past 3 years. About half of all refugees resettled in Indianapolis come from Burma, also known as Myanmar.
There was a lot of forced labor, a lot of violence, a lot of loss of land.
Once in the U.S., the stresses continue. Refugees must adapt to new environments, languages, and cultures, which can impact mental health as much as living in a war zone. That's according to researcher Mengxi Zhen of Ball State University.
They probably think have a really good picture of the life in the U.S., but the situation is probably different as they thought.
And there are barriers to getting help. Sometimes it's a cultural issue. Refugees from countries without access to mental health professionals may not be aware of available treatment. Zhang says that contributes to a stigma.
And in some of the Asian countries, having mental health issue is considered as crazy or some even like worse words.
Research shows many refugees aren't even aware that they might have a mental illness. Instead of seeing a psychologist or psychiatrist, they come to a primary care doctor's office. Here's Mitschke of the University of Texas again.
So a patient might come in, complaining of headaches or dizziness or even severe back pain.
But experts say it's important to remember not all refugees suffer from mental illness. Mitschke says refugees are resilient and lean on each other for comfort and support.
I think so much credit needs to be given to the refugees themselves who have who have lived that struggle and have learned about, you know, how to navigate life here in the U.S. and then are able to pass that on to the newly arrived refugees.
Kalima, the immigrant from Rwanda, was eventually diagnosed with PTSD, and he's still grappling with memories of the genocide. Water dripping from a faucet reminds him of the months he spent in the jungle. Loud, violent action movies are another trigger.
You know, it's been 25 years. I'm still having nightmare, something I saw when I was a teenager.
But Kalima says his PTSD is under control, and he doesn't want to think of himself as a victim. He tells the refugees he works with that acting like a victim means your oppressors win. I'm Lauren Bavis, Side Effects Public Media.
Governor Eric Holcomb signed new legislation recently to make Indiana the third state to extend Medicaid coverage for doulas. Doulas provide physical and emotional assistance for mothers, including labor coaching and breastfeeding support. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the hope is that the move will in turn reduce Indiana's high rates of infant and maternal mortality.
In Greek, doula means woman who serves. Doula Andrea Zepeda says the women who need her services are sometimes the hardest to find.
The people we need to serve are not always the women going to prenatals. So it might not always be in a doctor's office, you know. We need to find them in the community.
The Bridge Community Church in Logansport, Indiana, hosts a coffee shop and an immigrant legal office.
A lot of people like it because it's right on the river. It's kind of a place to stop, feel relaxed.
In recent decades, the city has experienced a surge in the number of Hispanic families moving to the area. Indiana's infant and maternal mortality rates are higher than the national average. Zepeda and other doulas don't deliver babies. They assist and educate mothers, provide support and resources on nutrition, safe sleep, postpartum, and many other issues related to birth.
We talk about it all the time in our program, you know, helping our moms not feel like labor's happening to them, that they're more in control of the process, you know, more than they even know.
The pregnancy program targets racial and ethnic minority women in three Indiana counties. Zepeda says many of these women face significant barriers.
Maybe she can't care for the child as well as she would want to, as well as the doctors would want her to. But what's going on with the mom personally that's not allowing her to do what's being asked of her?
With Medicaid expanded to cover doula services in Indiana, more women will have access. Half of Indiana pregnancies are paid through Medicaid. The Logansport-based pregnancy program was conceived with help from the state. Indiana State Department of Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Box says the initiative actually started in St. Joseph County, one of the areas with higher rates of infant mortality in the state. She says its success is rooted in community.
They really went to their community and hired women out of that community. And women that have actually benefited from the doula program are now going back and saying they want to be trained as doulas.
Women like Kelly Breen. Breen became a doula after her third pregnancy, but it was her first birth experience that made her want to help others. A time, she says, when she would have benefited from a doula.
I just wanted attention. I just needed love. I wanted affection. And so I was pregnant young, and I was on Medicaid, and I was unmarried. And my first delivery was so scary, even though I read all the books.
She thought she was prepared. She went to all the prenatal appointments.
But when it was time for my son to be born, I was in labor for 24 and a half hours, and he was born blue.
No one at the hospital would communicate with her.
And I had no idea what was wrong. And I asked everyone in the room with me what was going on when they whisked him away. And he's 21, and I still don't have answers for what happened to him.
Today, one of Breen's clients is Zuri Davidson. She's well aware of the statistics that show African-American mothers are more likely to die or have their child die during or after pregnancy.
In recent news, there's been lots of articles, lots of studies, a lot about women of color, and I'll say specifically African-American women, where there's negligence that goes on at times.
Davidson had gestational diabetes and wanted to make sure she had an advocate. She says Breen was a valuable resource and eased her mind.
She was able to share with me different ways to help manage it and helping me to understand diabetes better.
For her part, Breen says the new law to expand the service to all mothers covered by Medicaid will help bring the infant and maternal mortality rate down. She says more women, especially those from vulnerable demographics, need providers that consider them personally.
but you don't see the bruise on her back that he gave her before we got here, and I can. So if you and I can work together, then she can get through this birth easier.
The new law to cover doulas through Medicaid goes into effect July 1st. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. We're talking with members of Northwest Indiana's legislative delegation to find out exactly how the 2019 session seems to have gone so far, as we are getting close to the end, about the measures that they've introduced, how they stand, and the issues as well, too. This time around, we are talking to State Representative Marika Delaria-Reardon. She's a member of the Democratic Party in District 12, which, by the way, if you haven't seen the map, encompasses all of the towns of Munster and Highland, and portions of the town of Griffith, and, of course, the city of Hammond. Mara, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
If you will, let's start out with your assessment of how the General Assembly session has gone so far.
Well, it's gone swiftly. I think that I'm pretty disappointed that there are some very important things that are still being left out there right now, including teacher pay and increases for public education.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, on the measures that you've introduced here, some of them are certainly helping out here in Northwest Indiana, as ones you've signed on to as being a co-sponsor. But the ones that you have sponsored predominantly are ones that are very serious in nature. And they come in light of the personal incidents that you had to face, which are well known by now, of course, involving Attorney General Curtis Hill. The first one on this cover here, I guess, and there are two of them actually together in a way, House Bill 1573. And 1574. They're both related in cases involving looking at criminal law in some respect and about removal elected officials. Tell us a little bit about that one and where things stand on that right now.
Well, those bills died in the first half of the legislative session. They did not receive a hearing. There was a process that was laid out in House Bill 1573 with regard to how to remove an elected official that is that has been found to have participated in sexual harassment or harassment in the workplace.
And
the other one, lead touching, 1574, changes the definition of, creates a new definition for lead touching. So neither one of those two received a hearing, so they are dead as of right now.
They may be a little bit difficult to ask maybe the question, but what are your feelings about the fact that neither of these measures made it very far?
Well, Chris, as you know, the legislative process can sometimes be a lengthy one. A bill that I've been working on for the last 4 years, House Bill 1580, coverage for ectoderma dysplasia. It's a congenital defect where children are, once they have lose their baby teeth, they don't grow other teeth. And so it's a very rare, but it's a very serious condition. And I received my first hearing in insurance this year for that bill after working on it for 4 years.
So oh my goodness. Yeah.
If at first we don't succeed, we keep on trying. That's what we do here.
Oh, I know.
So while I'm disappointed those bills didn't move, there are a lot of issues that I've worked on in addition to the sexual harassment bill package that I think are just as important, and I have to keep pushing for those as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the other measures that you sponsored in the session this time is House Bill 1577, and it involves workplace discrimination. Tell us about that and where it stands right now.
Well, that one, too, is dead, unfortunately. Workplace discrimination and the definition of that was limited to businesses with I created a definition that would make it unacceptable for even if you had one employee. I think currently under state statute, I think it's 5 employees or less. And so, I mean, 5 employees or more. So this just says if you even have one employee, they shouldn't be able to be discriminated against. So that one, too, is dead, unfortunately.
Well, that's the way it sometimes happens during these legislative sessions,
yes,
to be sure.
Yes.
A couple of the other measures, one of which has a great impact here in Northwest Indiana, if it makes it through, and the other certainly will affect just about all Hoosiers, including Northwest Indiana. The first one is one that you've co-sponsored with State Representative Chris Chung. It's House Bill 1227. This talks about establishing a new township. Tell us the thinking behind that. A lot of it is what we've already covered in the news, but a lot of it may be just some new news to somebody. And where does it stand right now?
Well, as you know, there's been some issues with the Griffith Township situation. They've been given the opportunity to leave the township they're currently in due to what they feel is some misuse or of dollars. They just feel that they don't get the benefits of the township that they're currently in. They've been given an opportunity to get out of that township, and this would have given them a path to establish a new township, but it too is dead, unfortunately.
What we
were able to do was extend the length of time for Griffith to be able to find a home, to find a neighboring township to take them in. So while that bill did not move, we were able to get some language into another bill that allows them to, and I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it allows them to extend another year before they have to make a final determination as to where they're going to go.
So that's a measure where Representative Chung had sponsored it, and even though it died this time, there's a possibility he could maybe bring it back up in the 2019 session, 2020 session, rather.
Right,
you know,
right.
That's good to hear.
Right, but there is language in a current bill that's moving to get them moving forward. Mm-hmm. One bill I'm exceptionally proud of, though, that has really gone the distance and really is House Bill 1238, which requires, which as it came out of the Senate, it's going to require a study committee on getting Indiana reimbursement levels for Illinois hospitals that provide services to our Indiana Medicaid patients. We have a large number of Medicaid patients that seek treatment, specialty treatment, for their, you know, problem pregnancies or newborn infants that have challenges. And the level 4 NICU that University of Chicago Comer's Children's Hospital provides is invaluable, and we want to be able to make sure that our citizens still have access to that quality care instead of having to travel at their detriment to Indianapolis at Riley's for treatment, which is very challenging when you've got a baby who's going to be in the hospital for 18 months and they've got to, and you know, they have working parents that can't afford to be down here. So you've got an infant essentially by themselves if they're lucky enough to make it here. Mm-hmm. A lot of these problematic pregnancies, these babies have to be treated within 30 minutes. They can't do that coming down to Riley. So we really need to keep access for our Indiana residents to these life-saving treatments.
Well, it's good news to hear about that measure, to be sure. One of the others I wanted to ask you about here is one that you've joined in with a number of other lawmakers, including your colleague at Soliday on. It is involving municipally owned utilities, and that will have an impact for the ones here in Northwest Indiana if it passes into law, sure. House Bill 1347, and what's it really about, and how it stands also in the session now.
Well, 1347 is not a bill that I'm actually a co-author on, I don't believe. I think that's Representative Soliday's bill.
Mm-hmm.
It allows us to establish a study committee, but develop an energy plan for the state, essentially. What are our assets? What do we see moving into the future? The energy sphere is changing so drastically. It used to be hugely expensive to put solar panels or, find alternative sources of energy. And so with those prices coming down, we really need to figure out what long-term strategies we have for the development of those technologies on a wider scale and what that means for consumers. And so setting forth a planning process is essential to the way we are going to be able to regulate these industries into the future, benefit of our consumers.
We're talking with State Representative Mara Candelaria-Rudin, House District 12. One of the measures that we just talked a little bit about here is about what you hope that the state budget will show in the way of improving teacher pay. But you actually, you were a co-sponsor on another measure talking about minimum teacher salary. Tell us about that and where does it stand?
Well, unfortunately, that initiative did not move forward, but it's certainly something that I see as necessary. I just met with some teachers a month ago, and we know that people are leaving the profession. The governor in his State of the State said that was a priority. On the very first day of the legislative session, the Speaker of the House said that was a priority. Yet we have seen no bills moving with teacher pay. This measure did not receive a hearing, and it was very disappointing because they said it was their priority. I took them at their word, yet we have no bills that show it is truly a priority for the Republican majority. And I just met with a teacher a month ago, and she said she's going to be leaving the profession because she can make more money being a manager at Starbucks. That does not bode well for the future of our children. We could have the best and high, you know, the best tax climate in the world, and we will still not be able to attract and retain businesses if we don't have an educated and competent workforce. We rely on teachers to provide that educated and competent workforce, and they should be compensated accordingly.
Well, finally, Mara, if you will give us your assessment. Now, you mentioned some of it briefly at the outset of our conversation about teacher pay. What do you think the chances are on the measures that are up now that make up the next two-year state budget?
I haven't seen the love of teachers translate into actual public policy that supports the educators that shape our future. So I'm disappointed, and we've got a few days left here of the legislative session, and hopefully we'll see some measures moving forward. But the House Democrat Caucus will continue to push the Republican majority to do the right thing and hold them to their word.
Representative Candelaria-Rudin, thank you very much for being with us to tell us your thoughts on the measures that have made it through and the ones that have stalled in the session, and your thoughts as we've about come to the end of the 2019 session. Thank you very much, and I hope I have a chance to talk with you when you get back home and get a little better assessment of how the whole General Assembly session went. But thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Thank you. State Representative Mara Candelaria-Rudin represents District 12 in the Indiana House of Representatives here in Northwest Indiana. Lawmakers are nearing the ultimate version of this session's major gambling bill, and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the latest details as the General Assembly goes into its final days.
The biggest pieces of the gaming bill remain intact. Gary Casino operator Spectacle Entertainment could move one of its two licenses to a new facility in a more desirable location in the city. It would have to pay $20 million over 5 years to do that. The bill would also clear the way for a new casino in Terre Haute. If that happens, Spectacle must forfeit its second license. But there's a new provision, says Senator Mark Messmer. Spectacle would get a $40 million tax credit for giving up that license.
They're giving up real dollars and they're getting real dollars.
The final measure would also legalize and tax sports betting statewide, including mobile gambling on sporting events. Both chambers must approve the final version of the bill. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
It's been 1 year since Damian and Rita Gabus, along with the Tall Tree Board of Directors, handed over the well-known Arboretum and Gardens outside Valparaiso to Purdue University Northwest. It's now known as Gabus Arboretum at Purdue Northwest. The executive director, Stephanie Blackstock, was on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk about the history of the facility, the programs that are going on, and what is new as we go into 2019. She says the Arboretum began as a small preserve back in the 1990s.
They purchased 72 acres of property, and they decided to preserve it as green space. And as they saw more and more development around them encroaching on that space, they purchased as many parcels of land as they possibly could, which has now grown to 300 acres.
Wow.
And what they actually did is restored that land back to what it was before it was used for agricultural use. So they rebuilt, restored a wetland, they planted a prairie, they planted thousands and thousands of trees, there's ponds, there are, as I mentioned, the wetland and the woodland areas. And then in addition to that, There are also formal gardens within the Arboretum. And so those consist of two rose gardens, a native plant garden. There's a children's adventure garden area. And that area actually also has live animals. We have goats and chickens, turkeys, and bunnies. And we utilize those animals to teach children about where their food comes from. We also utilize the goats for invasive plant control.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll actually take them and walk them on leashes out onto the property, and then they'll stay in an area for a period of time to assist with that invasive plant removal. So along those lines, as I mentioned, we have those formal gardens, and one of our most popular attractions is the railway garden. That's what most people know the Arboretum for. And what the railway garden is about a two-acre area of hand-laid track with G-gauge. So they're model-sized trains running through that track. And they're going through historical landmarks throughout the history of the railroad. So there's educational vignettes in that garden that also teach us about the history of the railroad. And that was really a special interest project of Damien and Rita Gabis. So they developed this property and the programs that go along with it. Last year, as you mentioned, the Gabis family and the Tall Tree Board gifted the entire Arboretum, all of its assets, and then the staff as well went with this merger to Purdue University Northwest.
Has it turned out that having the Gabis Arboretum as part of the Purdue Northwest family has been not only, as you mentioned, about educational opportunities for visitors to the site, but also to the faculty and staff on both the Hammond and the Westco campuses?
Absolutely. Faculty, students, and staff on the campuses. And, you know, many people are asking us what's in store for the future now that the Arboretum is a part of Purdue Northwest.
Yeah.
And the answer at this moment is sky's the limit. What we've learned in the past year is that there are so many ways that we can engage, that the Arboretum can benefit the university, but also that the university can benefit the Arboretum and the clients that we serve there. And we're finding that there are so many opportunities. It's just, we've just unleashed all these opportunities for the future. And we haven't even been able to pursue any of them yet. We have a lot of interest from the faculty. We're going to see some of them teaching our community classes this year. We've had free admission right now for PNW faculty, students, and staff, as well as their families. So we've seen quite a few visitors from the PNW community. And then we're also looking to have a PNW night at one of our concerts. And then we've also been engaging a little bit more with the Purdue Extension due to this partnership as well.
I was going to mention, yeah, they have to be involved some way or the other, because you can't not talk about Purdue University and not talk about agriculture, since, as we all know, Purdue University, at least the main campus in West Lafayette, was founded as the land-grant university of Indiana, and that's where, of course, agriculture has always taken a very front and center role. So there has to be some role, I'm sure, that if they haven't already, that the folks down in West Lafayette and the faculty in particular at the agriculture campus have probably found this a very intriguing project and might come up here and get involved in things too, I would imagine.
That's our hope. We've been in touch with some, and as you may or may not know, the Purdue West Lafayette campus is actually classified as an arboretum.
Oh.
The campus itself does have that that listing. So there are some folks in West Lafayette that know exactly what we do up here, and so they'll be great counterparts for us. This past year, we've really just been focusing on exposing what we have to the campus community. As I said, there's so many options for partnering, but right now we just want to make sure that everybody that is within the Purdue community and the Purdue Northwest community knows what the Arboretum has, and we can talk about ways to benefit each other. Damien and Rita have always wanted the Arboretum to have an education, research, and a real scientific focus.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's concerts and weddings and some other things that we do to earn revenue. But the focus has always really been on that scientific effort. So partnering with an institution like Purdue Northwest really has always been in part of our discussion since the Arboretum's inception. This is not a new concept to partner with the university. It has always been the intent of Damien and Rita to have that happen. We've seen actually both ends of the spectrums. We've received a lot of questions about, is the Arboretum still going to be the same? Will it still have similar programs? And the answer to everything is yes. The Arboretum, the mission is still the same. The membership program is still the same. The Arboretum, while it's part of the university, it does not receive any funding from the university. So the Arboretum is still self-sufficient. We still need donors. We still write grants. We still have fees for some of our programs because we're still a nonprofit and we don't receive funding from the university.
The Gabus Arboretum at Purdue Northwest is located just west of Valparaiso, south off US 30 at Road 450 West and Porter County Road 100 North. Time once again for Eye on the Arts, and now here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Michelle Shirk, the Director of Development at the Lebesnik Center for the Arts in Michigan City. Welcome, Michelle.
Good morning.
It's nice to have you here as a guest.
Thank you for having us.
We often talk to somebody from the Lebesnik Center. How long have you been working there?
I started in October of last year.
So you have a big job. Are you like the first development director that the Lebesnik Center has had?
Yes, I am. There was an opportunity to bring me on last year, and mm-hmm. I do a little bit of marketing too, but really my focus is fundraising. I'm involved in grant writing, mm-hmm. memberships, mm-hmm. Anything that helps support our programs.
Yeah, that's important. It's an important position for a nonprofit organization to have, obviously, because you've got to have money coming in the door all the time.
It's true, especially because so much of our focus is on keeping everything free. I mean, admission mm-hmm. is free. Mm-hmm. Most of our programs are free to participants. The mm-hmm. first Fridays that we do are free. Mm-hmm. Events like this Zine Fest that we're going to talk about today are free. Mm-hmm. So our whole model is based on accessibility, and so it's really important to be able to support that.
Yeah. So you need a lot of unearned income to support those things. All right. Well, let's talk about the Zine and Small Press Fest, and it's coming up when?
It is April 27th, which is a Saturday, from 1 to 5 p.m.
And what is a zine?
A zine is basically a self-published mini magazine. Zine mm-hmm. is short for magazine or fanzine. Mm-hmm. These kind of started as a very homemade project. People would draw or collage, and then they would literally copy them on a photocopier mm-hmm. and distribute them in small batches. And that process is changed a little bit. They don't necessarily need to be literally Xeroxed on a copier, but they mm-hmm. still are self-published mm-hmm. Or published by small presses and distributed in small batches. And they kind of give voice to some viewpoints that you're not going to find in traditional media or in an art gallery traditionally.
I feel as if the first time I saw a zine was maybe in the late 90s or early 2000s, but they probably were around for long before that.
I think that's true. They are having really a resurgence yes. right at this time.
And the ones that I saw at that time were like comic books kind mm-hmm. of. Are they always that way?
No, you do see that though. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see some that are very comic book in style, but it can be a book of poetry. It can be a political treatise. Mm-hmm. It could be, a fan magazine for a type of media. They can really run the gamut. It's more about the smaller scope of publication and mm-hmm. sort of the homemade
yeah.
style.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if you really think about it, I made a zine myself when I was a kid and tried to do a newspaper for my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a feel of just really wanting to get a message out to your mm-hmm. community.
So what will the fest be comprised of?
So the actual event runs from 1 to 5. People are welcome to drop in anytime, visit all of the vendors. We're going to have more than 30, and they're not just local. They are also from Chicago, Bloomington, Illinois. We even have some coming from out of state. And there will be a cash bar, complimentary refreshments, and then there's also an accompanying zine exhibit. And that'll feature, we had a children's and family workshop at the library. It'll feature some of those works. It'll feature some art from the exhibiting vendors, and then it will have some of the work from our students that are currently in a comic book class at the Lou Besnick Center. Excellent. So all of those things are available from 1 to 5. And then specifically from 2 to 4, there will be poetry readings that have been organized by Rachel Calderon. She is an education student at IUN.
Okay. So this is the exhibit going to be in one of your upstairs galleries?
It is in the large gallery downstairs.
Oh.
Yes.
Along with, and so that's because that's where your nature
yes.
exhibit is up too. We only have another minute, but do you, what else do you want the people to know about the Lou Besnick Center and what's going on there right now?
Well, so you kind of touched on the fact that we have this amazing exhibit up right now, Nature Versus Everything. It's very mm-hmm. interactive. We're getting a lot of really positive feedback mm-hmm. on it. So I hope everyone will come and check that out. It closes on June 8th, but if you're going to be at the Zine Fest, then you'll be able to see everything then as well. We'd also then this summer invite everyone to join us for the Chicago Imagist, which will be our next show.
Oh, wow. I love the Chicago Imagist.
Do you? Great. Uh-huh. Well, you should come.
I should. I had a painting that was from my collection that was included in the Harry Who exhibit at the Art Institute last year.
Yeah, I went to see the Harry Who exhibit. It was great.
And who is organizing your Chicago Images show?
Our exhibition director is Laura Fosberg,
mm-hmm.
and she curates all of our shows.
Great.
So well, it'll be wonderful.
Well, Michelle, thank you for being here and sharing information about the Zine Fest and other activities going on right now at the Lou Besnick Center for the Arts.
Thank you very much for having us.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in again next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow we'll check in on plans for Indiana Landmarks' big tour, the Logs to Lustrons tour that's happening at the Indiana Dunes National Park. We'll give you more details about that. We hope you'll join us.